Where are we going? Welcome to this exclusive podcast produced by Spirit Watch Ministries that will show where life in our darkening times is now turning and how you can avoid the detours of deception through the hope of biblical truth. The Lord Jesus in Matthew 24 warned us over 2 millennia ago and how urgently we need to heed him now. Our host is Pastor Rafael Martinez, a seasoned Northwest Indiana-based minister, intercessor, and counter-cult apologist who will help you discern the journey of change we're all on as the last day of the last days now winds down. For more information, check out our Facebook page and our website at spiritwatch.org. Now, here's Pastor Rafael.
Thank you for downloading. This is Rafael Martinez, a minister in the Church of God Cleveland Movement, and I'm the director of Spirit Watch Ministries, an outreach of Christian discernment since 1993, which is now based in Hammond, Indiana. This podcast is called Where Are We Going? And it's our ongoing exploration of the depths of depravity found in our fallen world today, manifesting through religiously and psychologically abusive cultism. Part of recovery from cultism is a return back to that which was lost to it. And we make no apology for upholding this simple principle, that shattered faith can be rebuilt, but must be understood for what it is and what it does to those it grievously wounds. Over the years, we've used research, interviews, and conversations with those who are directly impacted by cults to give our podcasts the unique voices they have. Our podcasting, therefore, enables us to gain a Christian perspective into some very dark worlds of authoritarian, spiritual, and social slavery, for which we hold the light of Jesus Christ alone can guide the way out to true freedom, true peace, and true purpose. His imminent return to this world of woe is heralded by the rise of the slickest of deceptions, as he warned his disciples in Matthew chapter 24. We are only doing as he has commanded there, charging that you take heed, that no man deceive you. Our podcasts are available on many podcast channels 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on Amazon, Spotify, and Apple, among other places. Please let your friends, family, enemies, auto mechanics, therapists, and others know and share our podcast with others. We've said from day one of our ministry that we have no interest in contributing to the last days of deception now at hand, and have always preached, published, and defended biblical Christian truth and perspective that shows it for what it is. And on our podcast today, we are being privileged in bringing a singular and unmistakable voice who now speaks truth that needs to be told, a voice that can no longer be ignored.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Once again, thank you everyone for tuning in to Where Are We Going, our Spirit Watch podcast that we've had on for this closing on our fourth season. And you know, it's been off and on doing a variety of different things. We've had breakaways, we've had to go out and accomplish other things and move in other areas and circles, but I'm grateful that we now have some time here to actually center in back in on podcasting regularly. We're hoping to keep this up as long as we can, and I really am so grateful, as I always try to be, for everything that we receive, everything that we are blessed with in what we do here, because what we do is an important thing. It's bringing light upon darkness, and I especially appreciate the fact that none other than Michael S. Black, formerly Michael Shamblin, is appearing with us here on our podcast today. And Michael, once again, thanks for coming out. I appreciate you sharing, and I look forward to our time here together right now.
Well, thank you so much for letting me share today and getting to speak with you, Raphael. I have such, you know, high respect for you and everything you've been doing. So thank you so much.
A lot of folk have indicated they would love to hear an interview with me and you, and I'm just glad we can finally sit down and do that. So
I'm glad too, Raphael. I really am. I just have a lot of respect for you, everything you've been doing all of these years. And I just, you are, I said it to Phil Williams, but I can easily say it to you as well. You're also someone I would look up to. You were like a superstar in the Fighting Remnant world. And I, you were on it seemingly since day one, which has always been appreciated by me, especially nowadays. But you were talked about, your name would be thrown around all the time in the early years. And like I said, told you earlier, you lived rent-free in Gwen's mind and everybody's mind. And you were, equated with being Satan or just, it happened. It came up all the time in meetings. Your name was constantly coming up.
Really. I'm sure it wasn't very charitable either. I do know I heard at least one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I do know I heard at least one occasion during one assembly in which I think it was Rusty, forgot his name. Rusty Henry. He prayed for a death angel to come smite me or something like that. But
Oh, yeah, there were things like that. People praying for physical harm to happen, which was already kind of where Remnant was at that point. The extent that Gwen had us at already, people would be praying, for someone to be in a car wreck or something, some horrible thing to befall somebody that was speaking out, just speaking the truth about Remnant, like you've been saying, you've been speaking the truth. And that's pretty wild to think that we were there and that even I was going along with that mindset at the time.
Well, when like you said, you've got people who you think know better and have it all figured out. You're just gonna go along with them, and you find it pretty quickly. In an unfortunate way, that's not the way it works. But it's always been something I've always wanted to do is reach out to you, your mother, your sister, everyone there that is that remnant. I've often said and still mean with every part that's with me that I am the best friend Remnant never knew they had. And I've tried to be only a servant of truth. And I've spoken it uncompromisingly, and you even put your name on a lawsuit that was going to sue me out of existence. But God had other plans. And that didn't go very far simply because we spoke in truth, and the courts have acknowledged that not once but twice. That we've really felt this burden to bear up only what we know that is true about Gwen Shamblin Allara and the Remnant Fellowship and the whole operation there. We don't know. We're not God. We're not omniscient. We don't know everything. I don't know everything, that's for sure. But thanks to an awful lot of people who are concerned about Remnant, and Way Down and Gwen and you and others, a lot of light over the years has been shed upon what's been going on. And I appreciate your coming on to kind of give your own perspective on some of that I think will help a lot of people and help them maybe revisit their involvement with Remnant with a different perspective. So as we begin, let me just ask you, just maybe you can give us up to date real quickly. Where do you see Remnant going right now? Where do you see it heading? I know that your sister Elizabeth has remarried and that she still very actively wants to be recognized as the leader of the Remnant Fellowship movement. Where do you see it go? How many members are still left there, and where do you see it going right now?
Well, that's a good question, and it's something that I'm always looking at. And as far as numbers of members, I obviously can't speak to the exact number. I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't have access to that. But I can tell you that they've definitely lost members from when it was probably, around the Gwen and Joe time when they were. I think at the height, it probably was close to 3,000. I'd say probably at the when it got to the biggest that I ever kind of think it was around that number, and that includes a lot of out of towners and of course a lot of children. It's a huge amount of young people,
Right.
And I think since all of that time, the crash and HBO and everything, if I had to guess, I think they've lost half their membership.
Okay.
And that's my guess. And I know personally they've lost, you know, 40, 50 families that I know about. But it's, and also when I get to see pictures of the sanctuary, it's very private, obviously, very secretive. But when I do get to see, you know, video of the sanctuary, it does not look as full as it used to be. It's right. Very clearly, they're trying to put people in there now to make it appear filled up. I don't think there's that, there's not, a lot of people have left. You know, there's still the hardcore ones there, and I don't know how they do it. I don't know how anybody could sit in that auditorium at this point, seeing what they've seen and knowing what they've known, but they still do it.
And are they still just showing videos of her talking, of your mother?
Yes, replays. They do a lot of replays. Elizabeth is starting to speak periodically now, clearly, but against her, I think against her will somewhat.
Yeah.
But they do a lot of replays. You know, this is something even, this is an example of how sad it's been. Like for Passover, one of the, you know, the biggest festival in Remnant, arguably, this last year, they played, it was a, what the people came, who came from out of town and everything, they're all dressed up. What did they get to see? They saw a replay of Gwen, which is like an hour long video of Gwen, 45 minute to hour long video of Gwen from many, many years ago. And then right after that, somebody got up and announced that they're going to do a replay of Elizabeth's Passover talk.
Oh, wow.
So they watched two replays in a row for their big Passover, you know, celebration.
Wow.
Which is just,
that's astonishing.
It is.
I mean, it's just amazing how the, you know, the draw is so now being focused upon what clearly is becoming just simply a personality cult. I mean, it always was. I mean, mm-hmm. It always was a personality cult in which Gwen was exalted as the humble prophetess nobody wanted to, you know, to ignore. Mm-hmm. But really, ever since her passing, and it's like you're telling me here what you're saying is that basically your sister is emulating what her mother's doing, even down to just showing a video of her doing that. Wow.
Right.
Didn't know that. Incredible.
And she had, and I'll tell you another thing that's really, I was going to put something out on social media and I just never got around to doing it because I actually got through a source, a clip of this last year's Passover, but Elizabeth's video clip that they play now, I don't know if you've ever heard Gwen's original, her Passover video that they always play, where she talks about, it's extraordinarily arrogant, in my opinion, how, you know, Satan has been defeated all three times. At the end, she kind of almost yells it at the end and everybody gets up and claps. Mm-hmm. And she's referring to all three times as Satan was defeated at the cross. I guess that would be the first time. And then Satan is defeated at, I'm trying to remember what it was, but remnant being established would be Satan being defeated. So I guess Satan being defeated in heaven was the first time. Then Jesus defeating Satan at the cross was the second time. And then remnant being established was Satan being defeated the third time. So that was Gwen's kind of take on the Passover video we'd watch every year.
Wow.
So you would think how arrogant to put yourself in that sort of realm. And so then Elizabeth has taken it to even another level. And so she said now that there's been the plane crash and she's taken over and the remnant's going to make it. She's now doing, and remnant is, it's almost sad to listen to it. She says, and now Satan has been defeated all four times. It's honestly unbelievable. Yeah. I probably should try to get that audio out one of these days.
That would be incredible because it just goes to show you that, you know, cults are like any other called out there. They make themselves the center of human drama on the planet. And everything that goes on with the cult has cosmic spiritual significance. Mm-hmm. There's nothing they do that doesn't have a weight, have some sort of portent. And it's just amazing how they do this, how people can take the most simple of things in life, you know, when, you know, a dog barking or a cardinal fluttering or stuff right. like that, and right. turn into these oracles from God. And you basically, you know, you're not, what you're saying doesn't surprise me, but it's certainly something that I think they hide for very good reasons. And for many years, I understand the Passover, the live stream wasn't really recorded except that one, I think that one occasion. And I got the chat. I actually had a member actually give me an opportunity to view that one time years and years ago. And I actually had the recording. Unfortunately, it got corrupted, but it ended with you playing a video, a fiddle, and everybody was and all the men were doing the dance and all that stuff at the very end. And
and my black violin.
Your black violin. Yeah. You were going to town with that. And but I remember the video that they showed there, the one in which you guys were playing, were acting like you were Neo and Trinity in right. the mm-hmm. Matrix. That was all in there. It just goes to show you just how just completely blown up people are, can be with infatuation with their own minds. Sadly, it seems like your mother, however she started, began to really believe her own PR. And mm-hmm. but she wasn't always like that. So can you tell me just a little bit about your life before she got you on that path? And I mean, you guys, I think you were born in Memphis and then you moved to Cookeville? How did that work out? And how was she like then for you then? What was she like then?
Well, what was Gwen like? Yes, I was born in Memphis, and that's kind of where we grew up. Gwen, I would say, would be the stage at which she was probably at her peak of humility, I guess, if you could even call it that. Yeah. It was, I think that'd be the time period she would talk about. I don't even know if these are, anybody can see these anymore, but the very earliest Way Down Workshop videos that came out, she quit. She totally re-edited everything after several years. But the very earliest Way Down Workshop videos, she would be talking about how she shopped at Junior League, which was something in Memphis, is sort of a thrift store where people donate items, you know, then to be sold. And that's basically where we got our clothes. We were not wealthy. And she would, you know, make little fashion, little gifts for people and things like that. She was, I would say she was more, there was a humble point there. I think that's fair to say. Or uh-huh. more humble. But I do, you know, I do want to say, you know, I don't know that people often know this. Like David Shamblin would have known this, my dad. But and keep in mind, I want people to understand this is from my point of view, what I've seen. I know some people will feel differently, but I from what I've seen, I feel like her whole life, she was anti-authority wherever she went, mm-hmm. Raphael.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's going to surprise you or not, but from a young age, you know, my father told me about, you know, they met at the Christian Student Center at UT Knoxville. Okay. And she was already kind of a, I don't want to call her a party girl type, but she was close to that.
She's a very social person.
Social, but she, you know, I've got photos of her. She's at parties and there's drinking. I mean, she was, you know, she was a party kind of girl.
Okay. All right.
But everybody, they liked her personality and, you know, very charismatic. But as far as the anti-authority or, you know, I would almost say more anti-male authority in a lot of ways. But she, you know, every church we attended before, and we grew up Church of Christ. I'm sure you're aware of that. And mm-hmm. that's right. From Memphis. So we were Church of Christ all the way until Remnant started when I was 19.
Right.
And
I think the last place you went to was Otter Creek, right? The Otter Creek Church there in Franklin?
That's right. Otter Creek.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, at every church, so everywhere we went, She would be causing issues with speaking out of turn. She'd speak over the male teachers in classes. It was very difficult on David Shamblin. And, you know, when she felt like she had something to share, she would just share it. And she would be very clearly supporting women teachers more, like she would be lifting them up more. Mm-hmm. And, but she, I mean, she had it was a brazen, constant, arrogant way of living, in my opinion. And it would be a constant issue for our family wherever we went. She would, mm-hmm. she left a huge wake of, you know, Christian people in disturbing shock, like with how anti-authority she could be. And wow. especially in churches.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And it's also, it's pretty much my understanding that she had never been fully under any man's authority. And that includes David Shamblin, any preacher. That's my take on it.
Yeah.
She has never been under any man's authority, doctor, you name it. And that I always took that as like it was her own, you know, she was full of jealousy, her own self's method of like being on the giving end of abuse. I felt like she wanted to be there. She wanted to leave like whatever situation she felt like she was apparently enslaved in at the moment. It was like her constant, you know, her modus operandi. That was her constant thing. Getting out of her slavery, you know, being in her marriage was slavery, you know.
Really? Yeah.
You know, overweight was slave. You know, you think of the Exodus out of Egypt, you know, equating to, you know, Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt. She was, you know, the slavery of dieting, right? Everything was slave, being enslaved and, you know, her being a woman in, you know, the South. That was a very deep part of her. And she was a, you know, that's what I think a lot of probably women especially liked that about her, that she was not afraid to speak out over men. It was a draw.
Right. Right.
And she was kind of an upstart in a way.
Right.
And, you know, it gets into, you know, into more later years with Remnant, how she talked about submission and things like that. But that's kind of the early on thing. And I could say, you know, our family, you know, about our family, we were, you know, we were pretty very conservative. And I thought she was somewhat of a helicopter parent, you could say, and kept us, you know, close watch on everything. But that's where we were. And like I said, we our family did not start out with any money. We were actually, you know, in debt. I don't know if a lot of people realized that in Memphis, living in Midtown, really not very far away from Highland Street Church of Christ, where we went.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
But anyway, that's kind of the start.
Yeah, and that's one of the tragic realities of the lives of cult leaders when it comes to families, because the traditional family relationships become redefined freely by them and then really exploited for whatever task they feel they can be used of and in hand. And you've kind of really shared some sad but unflinching realities that were there. Because you know, Gwen made such a big deal about authority and being under submission, and it's really, I know it's not surprising to me. I mean, I've known about this side of her for a bit, but you know, the fact that you saw it, something, and how it impacted your family, and I'm really sad to hear it. But have known that, like I said, your father, David, he never really was truly. It sounds to me like he never really was truly a functional head of your household. And that of course, when that happens, mm-hmm. when you have a marital relationship that it's imbalanced and in contention with one another, that's going to spill over and that's going to make an impact upon the families and the people around them, especially when they say to stand up and be examples of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how did your family function onward then? They just really had to just kind of grin and bear Gwen, basically.
Yes, and you know, obviously we were young at the time, but David Shamblin, I think, had to put up with a lot more.
Yeah.
And he was a very, you know, I would say, very sociable guy, very likable guy. He was the one who really made the friends. Majorly intelligent man, and he had to put up with her a lot. You know, he was the one who, you know, I think he came within about 1 or 2 hours of earning his Master's of Divinity from Harding Graduate School of Religion. And, you know, I think he was socially much more kind than Gwen. She could rub a lot of people the wrong way. I think he was more generous than she was. And he was the social kind of person. So that did, it was always a burden on him, no matter where we were, because you've got to imagine he's not an idiot. He's an extraordinarily smart man who actually was trained theologically, not Gwen. And you've got Gwen who just feels like she can tell anybody anything. She was the teacher to all. Mm-hmm. She would walk up to a doctor, and I'm not exaggerating. She would walk up to a doctor and like tell him she thinks, you know, if there could be a better way he could, you know, inject somebody with a needle or something. You know, or surgeon, or she knew more than Dr. Otis Rickman about pulmonology than he did, right? Because you know, that it was like, yeah, laughable.
Yeah,
I'll say one thing drove me crazy. You know, one time we had these family visiting remnant, and the guy is literally like, you know, an astrophysicist. Okay. I'm not exaggerating. Like, he'd been in observatories, and he was like, you know, master's astrophysicist guy, incredibly genius. And so Gwen, after they visit the service, we take them out, and I'm asked to come along, right? So I'm sitting there, and I'm just shaking my head because I know where this is going. And
okay,
you know, Gwen is going to know more about astronomy and how all that works than this astrophysicist. I knew it was going to happen, and she did not let I was like dying for her to just be quiet and let the guy speak for a second. I just wanted to hear this guy just to say something, just say anything. She wouldn't. She talked over him. She was clearly trying to be the teacher, mm-hmm, to teach him, to put him in his place.
Yeah.
And she was always like that. It embarrassed David Shamblin because, in my estimation, he was way more intelligent than Gwen.
Right.
But she could speak for hours. She was incredible. A very gifted speaker. And Elizabeth has got that gift as well. But he could hang with her. But it just embarrassed the crud out of him.
Yeah. It sounds to me like she just wasn't very deferential in her treatment with your father because of the way that she basically steered your lives. It sounds to me like she was the one deciding where you'd be going to church or what you'd be doing or what she'd be doing. And it sounds to me like, again, that, you know, the headship that she claimed to be under really wasn't there, was it?
Right. And that's kind of been my issue with a lot of, you know, as far as the teachings of it all, I feel like that's where I kind of maybe differ with some people that, you know, may have gotten on, you know, interviews before or, you know, situations like that where, you know, they're talking about the submission, right? How she would talk about submission, mm-hmm, all the time. And, right, you know, I feel like most everybody that's seen to talk about that, they're, you know, talk about how the women are, you know, the put down, kept in their abusive positions, because that's how Gwen was teaching everyone,
yeah,
to do. You know, the line of authority, right? It was the line of authority. And that's, you know, seeming to be the absolutely only way the church operated with, you know, regards to, especially some of these younger people who've testified or exposed remnant on mediums. But, you know, I know that is the case. There's a lot of women being left in seriously tough situations. I'm not saying that didn't happen, or bad marriages, or like, you know, the positions they were in. But I've just been seeing that, you know, after my amount of time being around remnant, about way down, Gwen was, I think we all agree, Gwen was at the most high position as she wanted to be. But I think her, it was a secret way of operating, was to make sure the women were the ones making decisions. It would be like they were, you know, they were the, you know, it was, submission was just a word.
Mm-hmm. Right. She was training them, actually. She was indoctrinating within Remnant, and that's what I've always seen, mm-hmm. in such a way that women were being taught that, yes, they would obey their women, or they would obey their husbands up to a point beyond which that because they were going to be faithful, right, to God, they weren't going to obey them any longer.
That's exactly right. And you're saying, you know, taught, that's a perfect word, because I've even felt in myself, I feel like it's almost like it was an anti-men women's message in a lot of ways.
Right.
To bypass male authority. Now, keep in mind, it's not going to be obvious. It's not going to be just right in your face. Right. As far as they needed to leave the men in the dust with how much God was giving them the lead. It was
the while telling those women, make sure you submit to your husbands. Make sure you have sex whenever you want to. Make sure you keep his shoes clean. Make sure you keep the house ready to go. Make sure you are absolutely sweet and submissive to your husband up to a certain point.
Yeah, and it was dangerous and it problematic, and it spills over to their marriages, their relationships. And so it's like, you know, it appealed to I feel like, I always felt like way down, or especially Remnant, it appealed to women who may have secretly loved to be the heads of the households, or they already were the ones wearing the pants, and, you know, the phrase wearing the pants in the family.
Right.
And also women that wished they could be strong enough to be, you know, over their spouses or the men, especially men church authorities,
right,
or bosses or things like that. And Gwen was disguising this anti-authority way down message, was saying things like, you know, the wife submits to the husband, but the husbands are the heads of the church. You know, she's using scripture, and then she's deviously implying the opposite, giving these women permission to bypass the authorities. And that's what you're saying. That's what we're saying. It's, they were being given permission in a way, if it didn't suit their own personal spiritual weight loss journeys, you know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What I was just going to say, like in early Remnant, there were a lot of times where there's basic biblical examples, like, you know, the anti-authority teachings that people could find in the Bible. Like a lot of early years of the basics, or a lot of Gwen's early sermons, especially like when we were in the warehouse back in that back of Waydown building, like she would talk about, you know, Abraham lying to the Egyptians about his wife Sarah's real identity to keep himself safe, or, you know, the Hebrew midwives who disobeyed Pharaoh's command to kill the babies. You know, they're lying to Pharaoh and, you know, saying the Hebrew women were too strong, they deliver their babies too quickly or something like that. And then you've got Rahab, of course, the big example of, you know, in Jericho, lying to the, once again, the city authorities, the men, to keep the spies safe, the Israelite spies safe. And anyone who went against, like, you know, authorities or kings, or, you know, despising what they were telling them to do to keep their, you know, I say in quote, relationship with God, like that was their righteousness. It was lying and deceiving authorities, supposedly for the glory of God. And Gwen would be lifting that up, you know, especially the women. She would especially be honing in on the women all the time,
right,
who were not living under authority.
Right.
And these were all constantly referred to, like it was almost like a blueprint for women to leave, you know, in men too, but it was like a blueprint to leave the places or the families they were in, or the churches or marriages they were in.
Wouldn't you say, Michael, at this point, it's an excellent point, wouldn't you say that her creation of that inner group within Remnant called the Beulah Women was it actually that her attempt to actually create that kind of perfect society where women were, yeah, they're all the Beulah women, from what I understand, were those women who had husbands who actively opposed Gwen's creeping authority into their lives and did not want to move down to who were out of towners or men local who didn't want to move and be involved at all. But these are women that she pulled aside and had special attention and special loving on for them, and they were just socialized and brought into a point where they fellowship quite regularly. The wine and cheese passed around. Everybody had could commiserate about how things gone on with their battles with their husband. Wouldn't you say that her establishment of that kind of fellowship, that auxiliary within Remnant, was an attempt to create that kind of cult within a cult, for lack of a better word?
I 100% agree with you. I don't know if I've ever looked at the Beulah as being like that, but when you say it like that, I 100% agree with it. Because Gwen would have considered herself Beulah. I mean, she was the leader of the Beulah, and that would be a perfect opportunity for her to get to, you know, for them to men bash or talk about. I know that they were teaching the women techniques of, you know, because I've talked to so many ex-members, and I know personally, I would catch stuff, but she would teach the women techniques of how to deceive men. I would overhear things, and even how the women, how they should talk to the men to make the man think that she's, you know, supporting him. That it was coached.
Oh, yeah.
It was constantly coached, and it was, they had it. I'll tell you, Remnant had it down to a fine art. They had their own. I used to call it the Book of Sick Women. I was always trying to find the Book of Sick Women. I just knew it existed somewhere where it had all of their techniques. You know, that's what I've always kind of wished I could find.
The little pink book, right?
Yeah,
you had a little black book, and you had the little pink books. Yeah.
But there's been so many things like that. But I know that they had, teachings of down to just, I want to say even one, this is kind of funny. So they'll say, I remember one time a woman told me that she was being coached by the women leadership to say, okay, the word okay. If a woman's saying okay to a man a lot, that means she doesn't agree, but they would just tell the woman to say okay, okay, okay. Like they were coaching him down to that kind of level.
Yeah. Yep.
It's not and undermining the man. And oh, even, yeah. It, Gwen, no. In her, even what was so weird about it is that in her sermons, she would even admit it sometimes. Like she would say and I'm sure you've heard this in a lot of her early sermons or whatever audios, she would say the woman has the ability to undercut the husband. She can chip away at the husband. The wife can chip away at the husband. God has given her that power, right? So she can day in and day out, you know, as far as nagging, or she can either build her husband up or she can tear him down.
Right.
And but guess who has the power in that situation? It's the woman.
Right. Exactly.
It's not the husband. It's not the man.
Absolutely. It's all, and that's the way it's always been. This sex war that she has, a war between the sexes that she set forth when her ideals of marital and church fidelity didn't square with the husbands. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter whether they had a life before Remnant. It didn't matter if they had a church home before Way Down. It did not matter. Everything had to center around Zion there in Franklin, and it had to be there that the attention and the energy went. And if men had any reservations, well, those needed to be dealt with pretty quickly,
right?
And men knew one way or the other. They men in a marriage where something like this happens aren't stupid. They figure it out pretty quickly. They can either hold their peace and let it slide and go with it and go with the flow. Or they can silently resist on a paradigm where they're just being either very quietly, you know, resisting, or they're outright in war. And if they go that route, they know it's going to happen. and right. know what's going to page. I remember one gentleman who I won't name who I spoke with who had an issue where his wife basically opposed everything he did. That he had a couple children involved. This is a very sad story, but to make a long story short, everything he would try to do to establish, you know, himself as the head of the house, in church attendance, in being a good parent, a provider for him, everything he did was undercut by her absolute slavery to the webcasts, to the remnant church services, and her desire to attend every single local remnant chapter she could, participate on their pilgrimages down to remnant, and it all finally ended up to where she had to fight for custody, as many of these marriages end up becoming, and right. and enrich lawyers all over the place with something that should never have happened. I mean, it's simply because Gwen wanted that. That complete control over lives and down to even the men who were supposedly just there to help their mother, their wives.
Right. And I feel like that was one thing that always bothered me a lot in Remnant, was seeing, you know, I would be secretly trying to support men in a way. And I always felt that passivity was a problem.
Right.
Like it was it would plague these guys who are they're trying to be Christian men, right? And they're afraid of what these destructive women could do back to them. And I don't know. I always felt like that was, you know, an issue that Remnant, though, that was the problem. Remnant was the ones who had joined Remnant in many ways. It was 98% the woman found it first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I'm off on that a little bit, but it's close to it. I'm not far off.
Yeah, I don't think you are. I think at many times that really was the issue.
Yeah,
it really was.
But they were the ones who, you know, may not look like it, but they were the ones who started the class first. Then the husband saw the wife changing, and she talks him into joining. That if I heard it once, I heard it 10,000 times, and I've. That they were the ones who they were already in. A lot of them already were in these kind of positions where they were used to making decisions, used to running things in a lot of ways. It did appeal to women. And I've even heard that from media, you know, people from any media that I've ever talked to. They said that the prospect of it was interesting was that Gwen was like this business, you know, guru. She ran all these businesses. That was the appeal to a lot of these people in media, so to speak.
Right.
And, you know, and that they would be, you know, seeing on ground level, it was the women. It was the women, and they had but that was the sad thing too. I felt like they were not even the ones going into running. They could also pull their husbands out. And that was kind of interesting too. It's like when things, you know, they made the decisions and they were able to, you know, when things were going their way, they also had the power to pull their family out. Mm-hmm. And I did see that a lot as well.
Right. And that's still going on today. There are still women fighting the good fight and I've, of course, seen the fruit of too many where that didn't occur. Where women just basically became puppets to the will of Gwen, and basically have played along not only their husbands and wives or their husbands and children, but have played along families and friends and all kinds of people, all kinds of relationships stretching all over the nation. Where people are drawn to this central place there in Franklin.
I do want to say real quick, want to just say for the record, I'm not opposed to women being in positions of power within organizations. I do want to make that very clear.
Okay.
I'm talking about, you know, this is what I call the Women's Church, Remnant Fellowship. I feel like they were there in a lot of ways. They were like the abusers as far as what I witnessed. But I want to be very clear about that. I'm not opposed to women in positions of power.
Yeah, great. That's good to hear, because I know it's been some question from people I've known who wanted to know where you're coming from. But then, but I certainly do understand why you take the hard line you have, having beheld the horrors you personally have. I just can't even imagine living in a family where your father basically had his, you know, had his entire an entire role as a man basically redefined by your mother, and that he would that would be the only clothing he basically was given to wear. And he did, and I assume he did his best with that situation, but it just became quite intolerable. You know, one person, let me ask you this question. One person very close to her said to us quite about years back that there was some serious, although unreported, health problems she had back around 98, 99, after which she never was quite seemingly the same to them. And that it was at that point that her elitism and her extremism began to really peak, and then it began to take form within the Remnant Vision. Is that something you recognize apart from what you already seen?
And Gwen having some sort of physical problems in 98,
yes, back around 98, 99, that it became very quiet, became not so much hush-hush, but she just never publicized it. But apparently it had really, this person who was pretty close to it recognized that she just was not the same. And I wondered if you had were aware of that in her life, and maybe it means nothing. Maybe it just, you know, it just happened at the same time. Maybe she had a physical problem and she simply drew the line there between trying to connect the dots. But I wonder if you could comment on that.
As far as physical, I don't know. I do think there's something spiritually was going on in 99 with her.
Right.
With Desert Oasis, I do think something was changing in her. And, you know, I always thought that the period Desert Oasis 2000, when Remnant first started, you know, and she comes out in the smoke on the stage, you know, in front of 6,000 of these people, mainly women, you know, and starts talking about her new way that she's found, Remnant. And I know that that was having a lot of effect on her. So it, as far as physically, I don't remember her majorly having some major physical ailment. She did a lot of traveling. She was on book tour. She was gone a lot when I was in high school in those 90s. She was, you know, she was on Larry King and things like that. She would be gone all the time. But I don't remember something being drastically physically wrong. Okay.
No. Just wondered, because there was some speculation that she perhaps maybe might have had some sort of physical deficit or breakdown that contributed to a mental
no
warping, but, of some sort. But I think it was more.
But I think when everything happened, when the stuff started coming, when the stuff started coming out, and the churches started fighting back, and people were turning the books, she that hit her in a physical way. I remember her talking about she would crawl up the stairs and things like that. So she was physically affected very hard by the reaction that people had. Mm-hmm. And that bothered her to no end. Even when the Wall Street Journal, I remember, you know, in high school, they put out an article about her and they distorted her face.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that just that bothered her, like, you know, I do think something probably mentally was going on physically. Probably, I know that, you know, through my own experience, I know that stress and some of these mental issues can affect your nervous system. It can affect you physically. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were things happening.
Right. Exactly. Well, and I during this same time frame, we spoke not by 1999. It was then that, according to Remnant PR material and videos, you know, it's at that time you got tapped to start writing original music for the Remnant Fellowship Church. And you know, one of the things I've often called you throughout the years privately, I called you the Psalmist of Zion, because that's what you were. It's no secret, Michael, you're a gifted man whose musical and vocal abilities are quite quite impressive, you know. And I've always admired it at just how gifted you are in that. And at one time, that was a rarely acknowledged fact within Remnant. And then I read somewhere or saw somewhere that at 18 you started to pen Christian worship songs. Was this a development that you were out of your own desire, we're starting to work towards, and then Gwen seized upon that and exploited for Remnant? Or where were you going at that point?
Well, I mean, if you want the truth, and I you said that's what you want.
That's what we're all about.
Yeah. So in high school, I was having a very tough time. It was a very dark period for me, I'm just going to admit. And I had a tough time watching, we were in our Christian high school, and I was already getting very jaded with a lot of things, but I felt very left out with a lot of stuff. And it was just extremely difficult. I remember getting angry at God because I did not know what I'm supposed to be doing. And I didn't, I was struggling with that. And I do remember finding music in a way. Ironically, the first thing I ever did was actually write poetry.
Okay.
And I started writing. And then I went over to Gwen, had this, and of course, it was David Shamblin set it up. So really, David Shamblin gets more credit for me in music than Gwen does. He set up the guest house of Ashlom, which is her mansion, their mansion they lived in, and with a lot of musical equipment, like live music with microphones and speakers and instruments. So I started going over there, and that's when I first met David Martin. And because he was still in his band that he started in college called Full Access. And they would go over there and use the guest house to rehearse. David Martin and his band. I remember going over there, meeting him for, one of the first times, playing guitar. And it started there. And I think it was just obvious to me that I would be writing Christian music, I think, just from the environment we were in. And so I started, it would be along the lines of contemporary Christian music was what I started in.
Right.
And that kind of led to the possibility, I actually had a music deal, a record deal with Rocket Town in Nashville. So I was going to be a Christian music singer. I would have been on the radio, right?
Is it Michael W. Smith's company?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Wow.
And Don Donahue. And, I remember going over with Gwen to Rocket Town and meeting Don Donahue and all these people. And we met Michael W. Smith. And, they actually had a three single record deal. Like, they were going to have three singles that went on to Christian radio. They were going to develop me, and they brought a producer from LA named Monroe Jones to Ashlawn. He had like dreadlocks and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was going to, I don't know how familiar you are with Christian music, but like, there was an artist, her name was Rebecca St. James.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was going to open for her on a tour. And so I had all of that going, and that was pretty exciting for me at the time. And I was, that would have changed my entire life. And when the Trinity statement, when she, that came out, this is, I'm like 19, 20 years old, right? Remnant had just started. And I think in 2000, with the Trinity and all that stuff happening with her book publishing deal, Thomas Nelson, they canceled her book publishing deal for her second book, Rise Above. And she had like a 52 city book tour that they were going to fly her on a private jet everywhere, 52 city North America book tour. Everything was canceled. And at the same time, then we get a call from my music deal was canceled at the same time.
Collateral
so
damage.
I think it bothered me more than I even knew at the time. But like, it was tough because it was not something that I did. It was something my mother did. that caused my deal to be canceled.
Yeah.
And I was all excited about, like, this was going to be, that would have changed my entire life. You know, I would have been in, you know, the Lifeway Christian bookstores and all those CDs and getting to go into the big studios and things like that, which seemed super exciting. And I went from that opportunity to, it was as soon as it started, it was done.
Yeah.
And I remember the night at Ashland, David Martin, that Gwen sent David Martin to tell me, of all people. And I took it, you know, as well as I could, but that was kind of my experience with Christian music. And then I go from that into working, doing music on my laptop at the Waydown Building, you know, later on. And I'm writing music for the Remnant. And I appreciate you saying it was like decent music. I don't think any of it is like radio worthy or, you know, commercial available. It's very Remnant centric type music.
Well, sure. And sure.
Nobody in their right mind would want to play some of these songs.
Well, but, the lyrics, I understand what you're saying. The lyrics certainly exalt, her cultic worldview, but you obviously showed, you know, gifts. With your being sure. able to write good music and be able to sing it and present it in such a way. I mean, that's gifted. I certainly could never say to anything like that. She had a job for you, and that's where you got tapped.
That's right. She had a place for me to go. And I consider myself a very mediocre musician, singer, but it was a place to go. And that seemed to be where I was going to be fit in. And become a worship leader along with David Martin.
Yeah. Yeah. And so from that point on, that's when your development, your life, your everything you did was suddenly shifted from the mainstream Christian music market. And that was probably about the height, the 1999s, 2000, that was probably about as hot as Christian music ever got. In terms of marketing, and now it's simply not what it used to be. Now it's nothing like it is now. It's so much more market driven, as you've noted on your Facebook page, and not a very savory market either. But at that point, suddenly you shifted to becoming a part of the Remnant vision. How much of that did you really buy into? Was it something you really felt was truth as your mother presented it, and how much of that really eventually feed into what you're doing?
I went along with it because it was my mother, right? And I had grown up with seeing her in Waydown. I was supportive. I was all in, so to speak.
And yeah, you were. You were.
I really was. I mean, that's why I told you earlier I went on that, you know, Remnant's first mission, let's call it, you know, commando mission.
We'll have to revisit that in a second here. But yeah. Go ahead.
I was all in because I felt like, you know, I also want to say, though, I felt like I was more naive at that time. I don't think I was, I was sheltered. I was not seeing the people being hurt with eating disorders and weight down. I wasn't seeing some of the families being split apart already. I was very much just like, and I was the type of person, like, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to go like all the way. Like I'm going to be, I'm almost like an activist type personality.
Right.
And, so like I want to be on the mission if there's a mission, you know, like that's the kind of person that I am. And I went into it, it was almost I don't want to use the word excitement, but there was a camaraderie there because it felt like it's like us against the world. And it was easy to pull me in because I was already so skeptical of Christianity. And I say that respectfully because I know that you're a minister, and I'm not saying that in a disrespectful way. I was already on the path of being jaded but when Remnant started. So I was always keeping my eye out very closely on our new Christian industry that we were starting.
Right.
I was looking, because I was always going, one day, you know, there's going to be a percentage of corruption that begins in this place. And right. I was keeping an eye out for it. But I, at the time, when it first started, I was all in. You know, our sermons were hours long. People, it was like being in Remnant in the first, all these people that have joined Remnant and testified when they came in like after 2005 or something, they don't understand. Like the early Remnant, it was a lifestyle, like even beyond now. It was, the sermons were like 3 hours in the warehouse, and then we would all go together to go to lunch. We were together all the time. It was nonstop. So it was a fully immersed lifestyle that I was in. So that's all I'm getting is the propaganda all the time. And all you're getting all the time is, you know, some of the problems with Remnant doing, isolating people, isolation. The world is the problem, right? You know, it's, you know, they're evil, we're good. You know, you mentioned like the Matrix thing they played with the Passover video. Gwen took the Matrix quite seriously. Like, it was very spiritual, you know, symbolic, right? Like, everyone you see could be, you know, the bad guy in the Matrix, I think his name was Agent Smith. You know, he can, like, morph into, I don't know if you've seen that movie.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
It was a big movie back in 1999 when it came out. Keanu Reeves, probably one of his biggest movies. But you know, the bad guy, Agent Smith, can morph into anybody at any time if they're not unplugged from the Matrix.
Right.
So anybody could become Satan at any time. And that literally, you know, I'm kind of still a young guy, right? I'm very impressionable. So us young guys, I mean, think of how impressionable that was. We're going around and literally, like, watching people, like, is Satan going to come into you? You know what I'm saying? Like, that kind of thing. And it keeps you alert. It keeps you, like, almost in a militant mindset, in a way.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
And we were just, but there was also kind of a little bit of an excitement to it. I hate to use the word excitement because people were being hurt. But, like, it was, but there, was never a boring day, put it that way. Because you're also being attacked at the same time.
Yeah. You felt you were serving righteousness. You felt that anyone differing from the order that Gwen had set before you certainly had to be suspect, certainly had to be corrected, certainly had to be fought against if necessary, if not absorbable.
Right.
And that is something that you certainly tried to embody in what you were doing. And that basically where the Remnant vision really, really took off was around that. And I can certainly understand why she would use that the movie as the proverb in it.
Thanks for listening today as we explore just where are we going. Our prayer is that you have been encouraged and strengthened, and if necessary, challenged in your daily journey through life. Jesus is coming. You can fall with the night, or you can rise with the sun. The choice is yours. You can email us with questions and comments at feedback@spiritwatch.org. And if you need urgent personal spiritual help, email us at help@spiritwatch.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Please follow our podcasting at our Facebook page and our website at spiritwatch.org. This podcast is a production of Spirit Watch Ministries, taking heed that no man deceives you.
As you well know, appearances can be deceiving, which brings me back to the reason why we're here. We're not here because we're free. We're here because we're not free.